The Weighing Machine was created to help you, the financial advisor or investor, reach your long-term financial goals. Each episode, your hosts, Rusty Vanneman and I, Robin Murray, cut through the market clamor to find the time-tested principles that help investors succeed.
The Weighing Machine is inspired by the classic investing truism attributed to Benjamin Graham. The stock market is a voting machine in the short run and a weighing machine over the long term. In other words, emotion drives short-term market movement, but fundamentals and valuations drive returns over time.
Welcome to The Weighing Machine.
Enjoy, and as always, let us know what you think.
On the podcast today, we'll talk about which sectors are making money and our bias against the U.S. market.
We will also discuss the growth in exchange-traded funds, Americans' approach to saving money, and our newest CLS publication and resource called The Snapshot. That's all with our guest, CLS investment research analyst Michael Haddon and Nick Cadola. Plus my interviews with Terry Spath, Chief Investment Officer at Ocean Park Asset Management and the Sierra Mutual Funds. Welcome to The Weighing Machine. I'm Rusty Vanneman.
And I'm Robin Murray. Let's begin with a sentiment review. How are investors feeling right now?
Well, as we record this podcast, it's more of a risk-off environment. I think the concerns over coronavirus are still around. I think that just the market volatility in general we've seen of late has got people agitated, all the political stuff going on as well. And so when we look at the different markets, the stock market right now is a little bit of a mixed bag, but you could say it's actually more of a negative bias than investors have, a little more concern than greed. You know, that would suggest that stock market returns could actually be a little bit higher moving forward. As for the bond market, people tend to be pretty bullish on right now, and that happened, of course, after interest rates have plummeted of late. Some of the longer-term rates are some of the lowest levels they've ever been. Again, when you get sentiment this extreme, I would expect higher interest rates in the months ahead. The dollar is a safe haven, needless to say, if risk is kind of off. People like the dollar, and that is the case. Though it did actually, as we record today, actually had a pretty tough day today. And lastly is commodities. People are kind of bearish on commodities as well, which again would suggest a higher returns for commodities moving forward.
Okay, so Rusty, Case Eichenberger, client portfolio manager at CLS, wrote about the growth of ETFs in his weekly three that's coming out this week. We talk a lot about ETFs on this show. We like them because they're low cost, tax efficient, and transparent. Their growth really has been tremendous.
Case is absolutely right. ETF growth has been tremendous. Since ETFs were launched in the early 90s, they really have gained tremendous popularity. And again, for a lot of reasons, as you just mentioned, there are now well over 2,000 ETFs representing over $4 trillion in assets. But what's remarkable, and Case does show this in his commentary, is the growth rate. And the growth rate on an annualized basis has been over 30% a year, and it's been that case now for a couple decades. ETFs are the better technology. They're better than mutual funds. And I'm not dissing mutual funds. I think mutual funds, as I like to say, are one of the great financial innovations. You get diversified portfolios, professional management, they're regulated, reasonable prices. There's just so many different virtues to a mutual fund. It's just that ETFs are the better technology. They tend to be lower cost, they're better for taxable investors, and they have all the virtues of the mutual funds as well.
So Case also wrote about something pretty interesting, which is our so-called bias against the U.S. market. He discussed a reader question that asks why we favor international markets even though they have lagged in recent years. So what's our answer on that?
Well, again, I think that first of all, we think you need to be a global investor, and being global is your baseline. And it's not; it really shouldn't be a bias. It just should be a baseline from a long-term perspective, both from an academic and practical standpoint. It just makes sense to include non-U.S. markets into your long-term investment portfolio. He does have a chart. He does kind of go through a lot of different things, just looking at the percentage of U.S. and non-U.S. in terms of the global market. So in terms of the market cap, in terms of the entire market capitalization of all the stocks in the world, the U.S. makes up a little bit over 50%. But when you look at the share of GDP, the U.S. makes up less than half of that, about 24%. When you look at the share of total economic wealth, it's about 30%. When you look at the number of companies or the percentage of population, again, the U.S. is far below its market cap. And usually the one argument is that the U.S. is the most innovative country in the world, but actually it ranks ninth in some studies that Case was able to find out. So really the entire globe should be your baseline. And really, gone are the days when investors couldn't get affordable access to these markets. So really, investors should go global.
Well, let's bring in our guests, CLS Investments Investment Research Analysts, Michael Haddon and Nick Codola. Welcome to the show, guys.
Yeah, great to be here.
Thank you.
So, Michael, you wrote about the U.S. market as well in your Weekly 3 that's coming out this week. You said it's been a hero over the past decade. Annual returns have been consistently in double digits. And basically, portfolios invested anywhere else most likely have lagged. But this performance has caused a run-up on the market, and now it's generally considered to be expensive. Is that true? And what's the potential impact on future returns?
Yeah, and so we did a study kind of looking at CAPE ratios, just one of the several valuation ratios you can use. It cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio and basically smooths out the earnings so that you can avoid inconsistencies in the earnings. And looking at that, we did find that the U.S. market is pretty overvalued. At the end of 2019, it traded at nearly 31 times earnings, which is significantly higher than its historical average of just 18 times earnings. So although the U.S. stocks are expensive, it's still far below some of the extremes we saw during the tech bubble. But even at these levels, we've seen moving forward, returns can be far below average. In fact, the S&P has only traded at a CAPE above 30, just 7% of the time historically. And when it reaches above 30, its three-year forward returns have actually been negative. And this is actually dramatically different when we look at CAPEs that are much lower. If you find a range between 5 and 10 as a starting point, three-year average returns are 14% and are positive 99.2% of the time, which comes out to be 127 of 128 periods. So as we've seen in the past and as academic studies have often shown, valuations can be a great predictor of future returns.
Okay, so we'd much rather see lower CAPE ratios. I think I know the answer to this, but if the U.S. market is not looking attractive, where should investors turn?
Yes, international, as Rusty just pointed out, we're global investors, and we actually currently see much more favorable valuations from some places in international markets, one of which being several countries within Europe. Some data from NDR points out that Norway, Spain, the U.K., Germany, and Sweden all have CAPE ratios much below that of the U.S. And if you want a real good value, Turkey currently trades at just 5.4 times earnings, which, it's pretty rare to see valuations that cheap. So although being over-allocated to the United States has definitely paid off in the past decade, in the past we've seen these expensive valuations catch up to those countries eventually.
I can't add anything to that. The only thing I can add is NDR, is Ned Davis Research. Just thought I'd put a plug in for Ned Davis Research. They do great research for us. All right. Just in case somebody didn't know that.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And I'm going to turn it back to you, Rusty, because Case's last section in his Weekly 3 was about our rate of savings as Americans, or really rather our lack of savings. There are several notable studies that show Americans don't have near enough savings, that they may actually respond to new approaches to savings. So what's the lesson here that advisors can use?
Well, a couple things. First of all, again, Case is such a finger on the pulse of what's really important to investing. I mean, he's on the road all the time. He's on the road even right now speaking to investors. And basically what he wrote about is that there was a Federal Reserve study that came out last year that 4 out of 10 people in the United States couldn't even come up with $400 for an emergency expense. And however, the financial technology, the fintech industry has been really working hard to change this. And there's a lot of really cool user-friendly new apps, and there are new age banks that are implementing new ways for consumers to save in small, unnoticeable chunks. Also, he pointed out a recent study by two UCLA professors, which, by the way, have done a lot of really cool work in behavioral finance and consumer decision making. And they show that Americans will rather choose to save $5 a day instead of saving $150 a month. It's the same thing, but, it's just easier to save $5 a day than $150 a month. And you could apply this to high net worth clients. They may have already saved plenty enough, but they can always save more through a bunch of different ways, including being more tax efficient. And in this case, tax management through optimization, sounds pretty fancy. Some people call it direct indexing, is kind of one of those ways that high net worth investors can save more money. And it is a reason why here at Orion Portfolio Solutions and CLS Investments that we offer direct indexing solutions.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? I just put on a plug. I don't usually do that on this podcast. But anyway, job. The key point is that saving is like such a really important element to successful long-term investment results. And I'm real glad Chris wrote about it. We could almost talk about it every single commentary, how important it is.
Right. Absolutely. Michael, I'm going to turn back to you. Earnings season has about wrapped up. You wrote a section about this in your weekly three. What have we learned from fourth quarter earnings reports?
Yeah, it's been another strong earnings season. With fourth quarter results mostly coming through. But even with the strong earnings in the fourth quarter, the growth rate throughout 2019 was essentially flat. And that's even though the S&P 500 was up 31% last year, which is pretty surprising. But what might be even more surprising is earnings growth was 20% in 2018 when the S&P 500 was actually down 4%. So although over the long term, our earnings growth and market performance are fairly correlated, there are short-term market factors that can cause a dislocation. So digging into a little more of the numbers from just fourth quarter earnings, we're through about 87% of companies have reported as of today. And like I said, it's been a good earnings season. 70% have beat their earnings estimates and 66% have beat their revenue estimates, which is pretty much in line with five-year average. In fact, it's a little bit better. That comes out to about 0.9% growth for 2019, which actually leads to the first year-over-year growth number we've seen in four quarters. So looking at individual sectors that are having the best earnings performance, technology is leading the way with 85% of companies beating their earnings estimates. Other top sectors have included healthcare, communication services, and consumer staples. The laggards, when it comes to the earning reports, have been energy, materials, and real estate. But as we kind of mentioned earlier, earnings don't always align with returns. Since the earnings season started about the second week of January, we've actually seen real estate, which had some of the weakest earnings, and utilities, which has been middle-of-the-road earnings, be the top performer in sector returns. These are both interest rate-sensitive sectors, and as we've seen the 10-year come down about 40 basis points over the span of this earnings season, those sectors have had strong market performance, even though their earnings might not have been as strong as other areas of the market.
Well, finally, we have a new publication that we're encouraging our listeners to check out. It's called The Snapshot. Nick, can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a quick, nice little handy one-pager that kind of covers everything an investor could want. If you're just focused on the U.S., which, as we've already covered, you probably should be going a little bit further. But we do a bunch of information about that. We talk about our outlook for GDP growth in the U.S., inflation, probability of a positive bond return, probability of a market correction in the next 12 months. Moving beyond that, we also have some valuations for the U.S., just the general market, some specific areas such as large caps, mid caps, and small caps, valuations for U.S. growth and U.S. value. And then beyond that, if you want to have a little bit more of a balanced portfolio, we also do some fixed income valuations. So that's both the U.S. aggregate bonds, high-yield bonds, investment-grade bonds. And then we also start delving into international. So that's emerging market bonds and just general investment-grade international bonds. And then if you want even more than that, we've got some even better stuff. We have some general regions for valuations. That's Europe. You can say China, Latin America. You get the picture. And we also look at some global sectors. That's kind of the GICS type of sectors that people might know. So that's consumer discretionary, staples, energy, utilities, industrials. We cover all of that. And then if you want to have an even more diversified portfolio, if that's not enough, we also give some valuations for different diversifiers like liquid alternatives, broad commodities, some buzz name commodities like gold and oil. That's always fun. And if that wasn't enough, we'll raise the ante a little bit more.
And there's more.
Wait, there's more. We also give a couple reasons why we think the global markets could rise and fall. So all of this all wrapped up in one single page. I think it's a great little handy thing that people can use just alone, or it's also being packaged as part of our monthly perspectives, which get published every month, as the name implies. So you can kind of think of this page as the amuse-bouche for that publication. You can either take it as a loan, as an appetizer, and just be good with that, or if something in this whets your appetite, you can dive into the monthly perspectives, and that goes into more detail about some of the stuff that we talk about on this one pager. And if you like what you like there, we have all sorts of other publications that we do. So if you just go on clsinvest.com, there's a little tab that says Thought Leadership. Click on that, goes to commentaries. You'll have our weekly threes, monthly perspectives, the quarterly market outlook, reference guides. We've got a whole chock-a-block worth of stuff.
Say that one more time, Nick. Where can you find it?
clsinvest.com. There's a little tab that says Thought Leadership. Click on that. And it says there's a drop-down that says commentary, and that'll take you to all the stuff that we publish.
I just have two more comments on that. First of all, it is a pretty cool piece. And I think it's pretty neat because it was really driven by advisor feedback. First of all, the monthly perspectives that Nick talked about is kind of a series of one-pagers that that advisors really like to use because they're pretty easy to use. It's like they can just take it out and slap it up on the wall or something like that. And this here is kind of a synthesis of all that. So it's a one-pager of all the one-pagers. But it's kind of neat because it shows all the capital market assumptions, other words, the expected returns for all these different asset classes. And it's just in a one tidy one-pager, boom, you know exactly what CLS is thinking. So it's pretty cool.
Well, I'm just really glad that we got to use the term amuse-bouche on this podcast.
We say that every week, don't we?
No, I don't think so.
It's a $5 word. I've been practicing it.
Right. Well, that's going to do it for this portion of the podcast. Hey, Michael and Nick, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Next up is Rusty's Q&A, and today he talks to Terry Spath, who is the Chief Investment Officer at Ocean Park Asset Management and Sierra Mutual Funds. What'd you guys talk about?
We talked about a lot of things. Terry has been in the industry for some time and has a lot of great experience, and Ocean Park is a great firm, and we just had a great conversation.
Cool. Let's take a listen.
Well, today's guest on the weighing machine is Terry Spath from Ocean Park. Welcome, Terry.
Hi, Rusty. Thanks for having us.
Great. I'm so glad you're here. We have a lot of questions, and let's just get started. First of all, tell us a bit about yourself and your firm.
Well, sure. My name is Terry Spath. As you said, I'm the Chief Investment Officer here at Ocean Park Asset Management. We are a registered investment advisor as well as some other distribution channels that we have. We're based in Santa Monica, California, and the firm's been around for over 30 years. And I think that the key thing to know about Ocean Park is that the process that was created and was the genesis of the firm over 30 years ago about when to buy and when to sell is the same one that's in place today. So a very long track record of delivering what we say we're going to deliver and also just executing the same process day in and day out, regardless of what's going on in the broader market.
Great. Well, let's dive a little bit into the investment philosophy a little bit. The process hasn't changed over the decades, but your philosophy has a different emphasis than most firms. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So our investment philosophy, like everyone, we want to make money, right? I mean, we want to make money. That's what we're in business of doing. But I think what we're really known for and what we've really delivered on a very consistent basis is managing that downside in those times of stress periods for the broader markets. And the reason that we do that is because when Dave Wright and Ken Sleeper started the firm, they focused on clients that had made some money and wanted to make money but also not lose money. And so the entire investment philosophy was designed around when do we sell? As well as when to buy, but also when to sell. When do we make sure and get out of the way when an uptrend is now shifted to a downtrend so that we can protect that wealth for our clients? And that's really where I would say our investment philosophy is rooted, is on downside protection as well as the upside return, but mostly that downside.
Well, I do want to dive into the sell discipline a little bit later, but one other thing I want to talk about is something I've noticed about Ocean Park, of course, is the incredible stability of the team. You've all been working together for a very long time. Tell us a little bit about the key team members at Ocean Park.
Right. So the founders of the firm, as I mentioned, are Dave and Ken. I call them Dave and Ken. It's David Wright and Dr. Ken Sleeper. And, you know, they created the firm and have been partners now for over 30 years. And we have a team that's pretty lean, I think, considering we've got assets under management and advisement of over $4 billion, probably closing out on $4.5 billion right now. But the reason that we can do that is exactly what you pointed out, the stability. So I've been here about 5 years, but I've been in this business about I don't know, longer than I want to quantify, over 20 years. And my senior analyst, Marshall Kwan, has been here at Ocean Park for over 20 years. So he really understands the nitty-gritty of the investment management process. And then we also have a junior analyst who does a lot of the data crunching for us. So having that team in place with a lot of history, as well as a little bit of new blood that just comes in and kind of kicks the tires and makes sure we're still doing things the way we say that we do them, I think has really led to a really strong team. I love our investment management team.
I think because of the team and the philosophy and the process, one thing I've noticed is that people really like to tell the Ocean Park story, and there's almost a passion in terms of how people incorporate into their portfolios. Speaking of passion, how does the investment team stay engaged and passionate about the firm's mission each day? What are some of the ways you do that?
Well, that's a really interesting question. How do we stay passionate about our mission? I mean, I think at the start of it, we love being in the investment market. I mean, that's just really, we didn't accidentally show up in this type of an industry. And so, but how do we stay passionate on a daily basis is that we do a really good job of differentiating ourselves around that sell discipline and being tactical about it and have a set of rules that we've documented now in the past few years, documented in what we call cookbooks that go through all sort of different fact situations and how we react to those and what we're looking for to drive our decision. And I think that constant desire to continue to learn and test our processes and also the success of those and the track record keeps us really passionate. And I think, the fact that we're able to articulate that and have such great partners out there like Orion that understand what we are saying and ask us great questions and continue to support our work, I think keeps us really excited and passionate about what we're doing.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a couple of times about sell discipline. And again, I think that's another difference with Ocean Park is if you think about it, when most investment firms talk about what they're doing with portfolios, it's usually about the buy decision. You know, what's exciting, what's interesting. And you referred to the sell discipline a couple times. Tell us a little bit about that sell discipline.
Well, yeah. So most managers are, getting measured against a benchmark that they need to outperform. Probably every manager to some extent is being measured against a benchmark that they have to outperform. And what that has done to the industry, in my view, is really force many managers to just chase returns without a whole lot of regard for risk, or certainly not enough regard for risk, because they have to make, it's more exciting, it's more sexy, right, to have a terrific return and to outperform a benchmark. But equally important in our shop is that risk-adjusted return and managing a lot of the downside scenarios that are really important to the advisors that we work with and their clients. They don't necessarily need every last nickel squeezed out on the upside so much as they are much rather not lose a lot of money, A, unnecessarily, or B, in a really tough market. And so we have a sell discipline that identifies in a very black and white way on a chart when we were going to sell out of a position. Those are updated daily and the review daily. My team that I mentioned a little bit earlier, most of us sit together in a room every morning, look at every single holding that we manage across the firm and see, has that line in the sand moved? If it were in an uptrend, the sell moved up with it, or have we turned down and crossed through a sell and we have to get out of the way and it's time to kind of cash in our chips?
Yeah. Now, kind of related to the sell discipline and the way you're talking about it, is what is I know it depends on market conditions, but what is sort of a typical portfolio turnover ratio, or how long do you hold positions on average? I know it depends on market conditions.
Well, it depends on market conditions to some extent. So, I've been kind of talking in kind of brushed terms of, we buy and then we sell. So there's a lot more to it. So just using that that exact question about turnover, the rules that we've used to identify trends are quantitative. And they are based on the historic volatility of any particular asset class. So let's just take high-yield corporate bonds, for example. What we do is we look at the historic volatility of that asset class. And that's a remarkably consistent number over time. So yes, it depends on market conditions, but the kind of running volatility for high yield corporate bonds or most asset classes is pretty consistent. And so what we do is we study that, or we have studied that, and we decide what would our conditions need to be to have about two round trips per year, two buys, two sells in any given year, given the historic volatility of that asset class. So without getting a lot more bored and detailed and losing all of your audience right now, we find this stuff fascinating. We could talk all day. But basically what we're doing is looking to identify what would be a typical six to nine month trend in any given asset class. And so our turnover is going to be reflective of that type of turnover. Yeah. Some years is a lot less volatile, some more, but that's what we're targeting.
So it's responsive to market conditions. So that's cool. All right. So we have talked about a couple of really important attributes, again, I think of a successful investment firm. So first of all, you've got experienced, credentialed investment professionals who are passionate about what they do, and you have a disciplined process. How important do you think it is for managers to have skin in the game as well?
I think it's very important. Personally, I think it's very important. So we all have skin in the game. Obviously, if you don't want to eat your own cooking, that's probably a sign.
The biggest clue, I know. Yeah, it's surprising how many managers don't.
Really? Yeah. I guess that would be a hard thing to rationalize for your investors. Hey, I'm going to manage your money, but I don't want to put up my own money in there. Yeah, that wouldn't work very well here. So. We think it's very important, and we practice that internally. You know, the vast percentage of our liquid wealth is with our own products, our own strategies.
It is amazing. If you go into like the Morningstar database, you can actually look at, and just looking at mutual funds, how many of those mutual funds are actually owned by the portfolio managers that actually manage them. And the number is shockingly low, particularly for investment strategies, mutual funds, which are, you know, balanced portfolios. So really, it's just really surprising how low it is. And particularly given that there are various studies that show that the best performing strategies are those with managers who eat their own cooking and have skin in the game. All right. So
right. I think it goes back to your question too about being passionate. I mean, I think you're going to be a lot more passionate if you've got your own money in the bucket, right?
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Maybe
it almost should be one of the first questions people ask of a portfolio manager. Do you eat your own cooking? It really should be.
Yes. I can tell you at Ocean Park, the answer is yes.
All right. So staying on the process a little bit more, and you probably kind of flesh this out a little bit, but how do you manage investment ideas, and how are the ideas created, and then how are they incorporated into the portfolios?
Sure. So we touched a little bit on the sell discipline, which is a little bit easier, right? We already own something, and we have sell levels and we sell. But to answer your question about investment ideas, you know, what do we buy and when do we buy it? So we run rankings over the weekend. We have massive databases of all the available investment vehicles that are out there for us. You know, it's numbers in the thousands, and we have various rankings that we'll run through for strength of return as well as risk-adjusted downside metrics. And what those rankings do for us is they show us kind of what general asset classes look most attractive based on the type of parameters that we're seeking. And that allows us to kind of create what we'll call a suggested buy list. And we meet on a weekly basis. So every morning we're looking at ourselves and also looking at where to put money to work. But on a weekly basis, we take a bigger picture, step back. What's our asset allocation look like? Where are the strength of trends? Do we have, does our pie chart essentially look the way we want it to? And we will debate and discuss the vehicles that are on our suggested buy list, and that's how we. And then we'll come out with a consensus for what our first buys are, and what our first sells would be. But mostly, what our first buys would be, and that's what drives the buy decision and how we're going to put money to work that we're stewarding.
So you've talked about how the philosophy, the process, and the team has been pretty stable over time. But of course, the investment management industry is rapidly changing. How has your firm adapted over the years?
Yeah, I know. I was like, maybe we're kind of a dinosaur. So the industry has rapidly changed in many, many ways. You know, there's a lot of consolidation. Certainly, the fee structures have been a big issue. The shift to passive investing, I think, has been a really dominant trend over the past few years or longer. And I think what's really unique about Ocean Park, and the biggest reason why I came here and continue to stay here and, you know, continue to talk about the work that Ken and Dave has put together, is if you don't stand for something, you fall for anything. And we stand for something here. You know, we stand for how we buy, how we sell, our tactical approach, the asset classes that we've used, and why. And the industry has changed a lot around us, but our philosophy has not changed. And so I think that has allowed us to block out a lot of the noise as to what's going on and just stick to what we're really good at and commit to it. And, you know, we don't have 50,000 different products. We're like, oh, this is the flavor of the month. Let's roll out an aggressive tech fund. You know, we just haven't done those things, even though that can be very profitable. But it's just not how we deliver the results that we have consistently delivered. And so while the industry has changed a lot, I think the fact that we've just stayed consistent with our investment philosophy has just proven to last through all sorts of different news situations, political empires, anything you can possibly name, because of that consistency of our approach.
Yep. All right. So I think let's delve into the strategies a little bit, particularly on the Orion Portfolio Solution platform. Could you tell us kind of in talking point form about some of these strategies?
Sure. So we have three strategies on the Orion platform. The first, I think it's probably the longest, is the balanced risk, and that's in the diversifier bucket. And what it is a conservative approach to all assets. And it's an absolute return focus. So, you know, even on that last question, as the industry has gotten increasingly benchmark centric, we've continued to be what is now called absolute return, meaning we want to make a positive return in any type of market environment. And that has been a very successful strategy that complements with a lot of the other strategies that are on the Orion platform. And that's been, again, on there a very long time. We have a really long track record that we're quite proud of. We also have a diversified muni strategy, which is a tactical approach to the muni bond asset class. It's an asset class that does especially well with our approach. And it's also just a really attractive asset class for its position in the fixed income arena. And then finally, we have the tactical allocations strategy, which is a combination of ourselves and other managers on the Orion platform that delivers an aggressive equity portfolio combined with our conservative fixed income mutual funds that we manage. So all three of those are available on the platform.
And then with each of those strategies, which environments do you think they'll perform best, and which environments, market environments, do you think they will not perform as well?
Yeah, so when our strategies perform best in terms of we're doing the best versus many others out there is definitely in the high stress periods of time. So when you have a big drawdown in the broader markets, that's where we're going to stand up and shine because of that sell discipline we've talked a lot about so far. But we do also perform quite well in strong up markets. We don't have possibly the same upside capture because we're always going to be a little bit more conservative in how we're managing money because we always want to be aware of that drawdown risk and that max drawdown. But we do quite well in strong environments, strong risk on environments, I should say. So we shine really well in downward pressured markets, but also shine really well in the up ones. Where I think where we sometimes struggle, and we don't see it very often, but just so everyone's aware that's listening to this podcast, is a sort of directionalist volatile market. So real choppy, up, down, no real trends. We haven't seen one of those in a few years, but when that does happen, our strategies, which are trend following, tend to have trouble trying to identify a trend and make money for clients. So that's when we want to just people to be aware of when we're working harder and not delivering as much as we might want to be.
Yeah. So interesting. So how would you think, or how would you recommend, particularly on the Orion Portfolio Solutions platform, where advisors usually sort of blend different strategies together, How would you recommend that Ocean Park strategies are blended with other strategies on the platform?
Yeah, so we complement other strategies on the platform quite well. So the fact that we're in the diversifier side of things, we don't necessarily correlate as much to the upside or as much to the downside. We sort of have a lower correlation to all sorts of other strategies that are out there. So we pair well with some complementary strategies to play that role in the portfolio of diversifying through lower correlation to aggressive equity, for example, or other beta-seeking strategies that might be out there. So that low correlation provides some terrific diversification and pairs well with a lot of the other strategies that are available on Orion.
Neat. All right. So I want to kind of like throw some words at you, some words that are used in the industry that a lot of people might use a little bit differently. I want to kind of get your take on them as well. So kind of the first pair of words is, well, first is the word diversifier, which you brought up a few times, and also alternatives. How do you compare and contrast, and how do you use those two industry terms?
Right. So alternative is actually, I think, a really terrific, it's a terrific catch-all for everything that's not a pure stock and not a pure bond. That's how we often think about it. So it's something that's going to march to a different drum than the pure equity markets and march to a different drum than the pure bond markets. And I think that's an increasingly important part of any investor's portfolio. And we also think of that a little in a similar vein to diversifier. And diversification, you know, as you know, and the advisors listening to this are aware, when you add something to your portfolio that has a low correlation to what's existing already in it, it's going to diversify the risk of that portfolio and typically either reduce the risk while keeping the return the same or improve the return in a positive way from a risk perspective. So alternative and diversifier are what we use to identify parts of a portfolio or investment vehicles that have a low correlation to pure beta stocks and a low correlation to bonds.
Gotcha. All right, here's another two words that are often used sort of interchangeably. It is tactical management, investment management, and then active. So comparing and contrasting the words tactical and active.
Oh my gosh. Okay, these are tough ones. Because active was, has been often used to just say, well, it's not passive, right? Passive being I'm hugging a benchmark, I'm trying to get the lowest cost S&P 500 fund that's out there, whereas active is I'm trying to outperform that benchmark. Maybe a subset or a third dimension would be tactical. So when we talk about tactical at Ocean Park, we are truly, we like to say we're truly tactical. We're not sort of a little bit active and a little bit passive. Like, we're truly tactical. And the way we define that is that we have these robust rules that we use to buy and to sell. And we will go at times entirely into cash, for example. If everything is blowing up, this happened in the fourth quarter of 2018. Everything lost money in the fourth quarter of 2018. A lot of active managers would potentially reduce relative to their benchmark, whereas a tactical manager, the way we think about it is we're willing to completely get out of the way and temporarily park lots of money in cash or lots of money in any other asset class if that's what the market conditions are dictating at the time. So we're truly, truly tactical.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so let's move into a fun question, because as we're recording this, the markets are having a lot of fun. There's a lot of volatility going on, obviously, from health epidemics to election uncertainty to markets being overvalued to all kinds of things. What is your take on all this global volatility right now? And when it comes to the current market environment, what excites you the most and what gives you the most concern?
Okay, lots to unpack.
I just gave you like five questions in one sentence.
Yeah, you did. So let's first, I guess, talk about what's going on in the markets. I mean, I think we've seen a lot of volatility. You know, whenever valuations get very stretched, which they did in the equity markets, you're at risk for any sort of headline, whether it's, you know, coronavirus, political outcomes. you're just vulnerable to those types of news headlines. And whether they're just a shock that's going to hurt the market for a couple of days or something, or the more substantive impact, those are things that then have to be assessed. So right now, I mean, we're seeing a lot of market volatility. I wouldn't be surprised to see that continue, just given the kind of an uncertain political environment, uncertain growth rates in the emerging markets. But we'll have to wait and see, and we're going to see, you know, what the impact is. Right now, we continue to follow our process. Not right now. We always continue to follow our process. Right now, we haven't had to make any adjustments to our portfolios. But again, we're going to assess that we do and did again this morning and will again tomorrow morning, look at every single position to see if there's something that we need to buy or something that we need to sell. When we're looking at the market right now, what are we most excited about? The things that excite us might not excite everybody else, but we're really excited about the preferred stock asset class. This is a really terrific asset class. It just kind of trends nicely to the upside. It falls a lot more slowly than equities do. So we can participate in a lot of the upside and get out of the way fairly quickly. And so that's an area that that we're most excited about right now in this sort of more volatile environment, but that is still generally moving to the upside.
All right. So I have a bunch of more philosophical, and I like to think fun questions. Hope you're ready for them. So the first one is, again, going back to the industry. And when I guess I say industry, I guess it's kind of a broad term. We could be talking about investment management or investment advice, but which trends do you think are the most important? And kind of on the flip side of that coin, which trends within the industry do you think are the most overrated?
What are the best industry trends that we're seeing, and what are the ones that are most overrated? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, I'll start with the overrated ones. That's easier to answer. but I do think that one of the most overrated trends in the industry is to buy cheap ETFs and use that to manage your portfolio and kind of set it, forget it. That's not, I think, a way that holds up over longer periods of time. So, you know, most asset classes out there, the active or tactical manager outperforms the benchmark. And so this trend to, you know, cheap ETFs, it works if you're trying to get the performance of the S&P 500, absolutely go out and buy a cheap ETF. If you're interested in a more diversified portfolio, emerging market debt, preferred stocks, muni bonds, high yield corporate bonds, floating rate loan funds, that could go on. A cheap ETF is consistently outperformed by an active manager, and even more so by a tactical manager managing that active management. So that's, I think, one of the big industry trends that we're constantly finding ourselves up against and trying to, you know, show the difference in that. And what I do think is kind of a positive industry trend is the fact that there's still, I guess, lack of pure efficiency in so many different asset classes. And that really gives us an opportunity. I mean, I just touched on emerging market debt, for example. I mean, this is an area of the market that can be so interesting and so exciting, and you can really deliver above average returns under the right market conditions and using the right set of rules. So the fact that, you know, that there's still so many of those different opportunities out there, I think, is what I think is terrific about the industry and what we still find really interesting.
Okay, speaking of industry trends, another big one, of course, is the upcoming wealth transfer from baby boomers to millennials and Gen Xers. Is there anything your firm is doing regarding that, and particularly in terms of resources for advisors?
Right. Yeah, that's a huge trend, right? It's from that transfer, that generational transfer. And I think that we take the point of view that everyone really, most everyone, needs guidance into how to manage their money and how to, you know, manage the risk that they have, and also, you know, preserve the wealth that they have and be able to use it in the ways that they want. So we're constantly trying to meet the expectations that advisors have for us, and also articulate clearly, you know, what we deliver, and doing that with honesty and integrity. And I think that doing that and having and working with advisors that do the same has really benefited us in terms of this this period of time that's going to be going on for years and years, this massive transfer of wealth.
Another philosophical question here is, and I think we've kind of touched upon this a little bit, but let's sort of kind of twist the question a little bit is, and I'm curious, you've been in the industry for a couple decades, you know a lot of people in the industry, what do you think makes a good investment money manager? So in other words, if you're shopping from a money manager and you couldn't eat your own cooking at Ocean Park, what attributes would you be looking for in a money manager?
Oh, wow. Yeah. What attributes make a good investment money manager? I mean, I think first and foremost, I think something that really helps is to seek a manager that has a long track record that you can look to and see, like, this is the type of behavior, the type of performance, the type of risk management that that not only they talk about that they want to deliver, but that they have delivered for clients consistently over time. And so I think that's one thing that I think really qualifies a money manager as being someone that's worth taking a look at if you have that long track record to take to study, because that allows you to see if they're going to meet the expectations that you want. And at the end of the day, you know, at Ocean Park, we want to meet the expectations that we've said that we're offering for advisors. And so I think that that's something that that allows people to really understand whether that's going to happen or not. If they're really going to meet the expectations that they're seeking.
That's a great point. I think that successful investor experiences depend so much on the expectations. And you're absolutely right. When you get that track record and you have something to match up against, then investors can kind of get that at least a reasonable level of comfort. And again, if they have that reasonable level of comfort, understand how a strategy should perform in different market environments, then again, in the end, that should be a good investor experience. Great. All right. So that's the investment manager. Now let's kind of twist it and talk about financial advisors, who is our audience and who are our clients. What do you think makes a good financial advisor? And what would you look for if you were shopping for a financial advisor yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I think it all kind of comes down to what we've been talking about, which is, you know, making sure your expectations match and communicating that very fully. And I think a good financial advisor is able to understand their own clients, and they work to understand that. And I think that develops a lot of honesty and integrity in their relationship. When you've got a financial advisor, it's really trying to understand their client so that they can best meet the expectations for that client and deliver what they think would be a fair experience based on that. So I think it all comes down to that communication, honesty, you know, integrity. Those are sort of obvious, but they're so important in our industry, in particular, where there's sometimes, you know, we don't have the greatest reputation. If you can really demonstrate that honesty and integrity, and I think you do that by being very consistent about doing what you say you're going to do. So that's what I would say about that.
Say what you do and do what you say. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so another thing is, you know, a lot of investors are listening, obviously, to this podcast. What do you think makes a good investment client, a good investor?
A good investor or a good client? I mean, yeah, I think everyone, most everyone needs guidance, even if they sometimes aren't sure that they do. And so I think that there has to be that kind of mutual trust for the client, for their advisor, and to understand what the advisor's role is, as well as what their own role is in the situation. And again, it can all come back to communication and expectations, because most of the time, you're delivering what you say you're going to deliver. But in our case, for example, with Ocean Park, we say we're going to manage your downside risk. Most of the time, markets go up. But in those periods of high stress, we manage that downside very, very well. And so I think what makes a good investment manager client is to understand, is that they understand what they should expect out of their investment portfolio, which is not easy.
Yeah.
But it does build trust when you can continue to have that communication and have it occur day in and day out.
It's all comes back to expectations. You're right. Just managing them. And I think for the investors to kind of have their expectations properly set. So All right. So in terms of another fun question here I like to ask is, what are you reading these days? Do you have any hot book tips, any book recommendations for the listeners?
Oh, gosh. I'm a big reader. I think that that's a great way to learn, is to just kind of sit and study a book. So mm-hmm. I've got lots of recommendations. I'll stick to my nonfiction ones maybe for this one. I'm in this amazing book club even that we're not reading really business-related books.
Yeah.
But I think in the industry, I mean, some of the good ones that are out right now that I like are Bob Iger, who's the head of Disney, has The Ride of a Lifetime out, which is a great read for anyone that is interested in hearing how a very successful creative person operates at the top. Start With Why is another one by Simon Sinek that I think is always a great read for people to really understand what their why is in life and to help them understand what other people's are so that they could best work with them. Those are a couple of the top ones. I'll just add also Principles, which is it's a commitment of a read, but it's written by Ray Dalio, who's a very successful investment manager on the East Coast. And he goes through principle after principle of what he is seeking in his own company and what he has found in life to help him be as successful as he is, not just in business, but also with his family and his relationships. So all three of those, Ride of a Lifetime, Principles, Start With Why, are just a handful of great books that are out there for listeners to pick up and read.
Great tips. I know Start With Why. I've seen and heard a lot of people talk about that. I have not read it. I've done the cheat sheet way of watching videos, and then of
good
course,
enough.
Yeah, exactly. And with Ray Dalio, obviously, I've been following him for many, many years. I have not bought the book,
yeah.
Though. Again, a lot of people on my team have bought the book and have read it. And then the Disney recommendation. That's a great tip. I'm definitely going to write that one down too. So that's cool.
Oh, good. You know, there's an app called Blinkist
Had that on my to-do list to check that out for so long.
All these books, like listening to cheat sheets of all these great books, because who has time to read all the wonderful things that are out there? I mean, that's a nice way to kind of get the summary and the greatest bits of information out of these books without having to, you know, commit 10 or 20 hours to actually reading it.
Yeah, I have the habit, like I bet you do too, of buying probably way more books than I can actually read.
I know, right?
And people walk into my library and they'll say, like, have you read all these books? And it's like, well, this is a better indication of my interest as opposed to my knowledge, but I hope to read all these. But anyway, well, Terry, I really appreciate all the time you've given us here today. So first of all, how can listeners learn more about your firm? Where can they go and find more?
Oh, yeah. So a couple of ways. Ocean Park AM for asset management, oceanparkam.com is our website. And I think it looks really good. We've updated it fairly recently. And it also has the contact information for who your salesperson that represents Ocean Park would be, the best person for you to call if you have further questions. We have a lot of literature on there. We also have links to a piece that we put out every couple of weeks, a video called The Market Minute. And it covers all sorts of different topics that we're thinking about and writing about here at Ocean Park. We publish that, put that out about every, that video out about every other week. And that's something that you can subscribe to on email or also find through oceanparkam.com.
Great tip. I've watched Market Minute and it's very well done. So that's a great
Thanks.
Tip.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We produce it in-house. We're really pleased with it.
Cool. Well, any closing words?
I guess, yeah, just thanks for the time, Rusty. I mean, the takeaway for Ocean Park is that for most investors, you know, we really think it's easy to buy, but it can be really hard to sell. And so I think having a manager that offers that tactical diversification, it complements so many of the other opportunities available at Orion Portfolio Solutions. And so if you are using us, thank you. And if you're curious, please reach out to us, check out our website, and hopefully we can meet your needs.
Great. Well, Terry, thanks again for your time, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Rusty. Have a great day.
Good stuff. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Rusty, take us out with your final thoughts.
Stay balanced and stay the course.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening to The Weighing Machine, and thank you for your time and trust in Orion Advisor Solutions. The Weighing Machine is hosted by Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Officer at Orion Advisor Solutions, and me, Robin Murray, freelance writer and editor. If you have feedback or questions about our podcast today, please send us a note at rusty@orion.com.